Welcome back to the Infotagent podcast, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom. This is the first major public health crisis in the age of social media disinformation, and we're here to try and make sense of it. I'm Damien Collins MP, co-founder of Infotagent, and today we're joined by Tristan Harris, a former Google product designer and the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology based in California, where he also hosts their podcast called Your Undivided Attention. We'll also be hearing, as always, from our resident experts, the disinformation analyst Dr. Charles Creel and John Quinlan, the CEO of Iconic Labs. In this podcast, we'll be talking about how to create a vaccine for the information virus as well as COVID-19. Tristan, it's great to have you on the Infotagent podcast. I did look that the Center for Humane Technology has a podcast as well, and this is sadly only podcast number 9 for Infotagent. I noticed that your center's up to 17 now, maybe more. So we're still playing catch up on this. We've met before when you've given evidence to the Select Committee and gave us some great advice when we were doing our inquiries on disinformation. In fact, I remember the first time we met was when I was in Washington with the Select Committee, and we met Senator Warner, and he said, "You've got to meet Tristan Harris, who's in town at the moment." And by good fortune, and thanks to his office, we managed to give you a lift to Dulles Airport from the centre of the city. And in that time, you managed to give us a great briefing on the fantastic work that the centre does and that you've championed on. And a lot of that, for people who aren't familiar with this work, and is really setting out an agenda of a positive future for technology, learning from maybe some of the mistakes that have been made, a way for technology to be less acquisitive in the data and the monitoring of its users and the demand for their attention. And one of the themes, if you like, we've been discussing on the podcast is technology has, whether we like it or not, has a really important part to play in something like coronavirus, in trying to direct people to the right information, and through the contact tracing apps as well, helping to identify people that need to be checked and tested, and helping us with the lockdown as well. But there is a reluctance around the world in countries where you have a choice about whether you sign up to these apps or not to use them. And I wonder if this is evidence of a growing trust deficit with technology. And we've seen opinion polls in the last few weeks also demonstrating that people are increasingly concerned about disinformation on social media, would support governments taking more action to require social media companies to be more responsible. And I'd just like to be really interested in get your thoughts on how you see this problem, both in terms of the need for the tech companies maybe to step up in terms of dealing with the bad stuff, but also to win public trust so that technology can be part of the solution to coronavirus.
Yeah, you know, as you know, I used to be a design ethicist at Google before leaving to start this nonprofit, the Center for Humane Technology. So what's interesting about our work and our lens is we have a kind of insider's view of, you know, what motivates technology companies' action, the culture and the incentives that kind of operate when you're, you know, at work during a given week at the office. Obviously, coronavirus is a different kind of situation, but I think the thing that we've called out from the beginning is you cannot have services that are essentially holding the collective consciousness or have become the new default public infrastructure. You cannot have them operating in the private interest, for purely private interest. We always go back to the saying by Marc Andreessen, who was the founder of Netscape, that his essay in, I think it was 2009, that software is eating the world. Because the whole point is that software or technology will take any part of your society, whether it's taxi cabs or airline travel or attention mapping or advertising, and it'll just take that part of society and it'll just do it more efficiently once you have the technology running the show, because technologies basically mean no human labor. So when you have technology eating the world, what you really have is the digital eats the physical, the private is eating the public, because we have public interest areas of life, whether it's elections or public information or emergency broadcasting systems, or, you know, what is true in the case of a pandemic, or what should we do, public health information. And when you have private companies who essentially now own those those organs of society. You know, you've privatized your liver and your kidneys. In this case, your liver and your kidneys are your public information environment. Once you do that, if the companies are not taking responsibility for the public interest, then that can cause real harm. Now, the unprecedented situation is you have a small handful of technology companies in either California or the state of Washington that have actually created globally dominant platforms. So it's not just that they're taking over, you know, the UK's public interest. They're taking over hundreds of countries' public interests. And so I think the fundamental governance challenge is, how can you have a Facebook, a Google, a TikTok, a Instagram take over the mental health of children of hundreds of different countries, or the elections infrastructure of hundreds of different countries in the case of their public information environment, and actually take responsibility for that many diverse moral views? Because each government might have different ideas and standards about what it wants to do. And you can typically only get companies to do the right thing after you've yelled and complained about it. Just one last thing on this metaphor. When the digital takes over the physical, we often lose the protections that we had in that physical environment. So let's use an example of, you know, you have a defense department in the UK, and if Russia or China tried to fly a plane into the UK, you would shoot it down with your defense department, right? But when you digitize your society and you now virtualize it in this upper realm, now all those protections go away. So if Russia or China try to fly an information plane into your country, they're greeted not by the Department of Defense and a cruise missile, but they're met by a Facebook or Google advertising algorithm that says, yeah, which zip code or which individual conspiracy theorist do you want to target? And they'll happily give you access. So it's not just that we've lost the protections. In many cases, we actually have systems that assist bad actors in reaching anyone in your society. And I think what this fundamentally exposes is that, again, once you have private interest taking over public interest parts of life, the private company has to now offer a fiduciary or duty of care-like relationship to protect that public interest part of life. And that's the kind of basis, I think, for this whole conversation.
I think that's absolutely right. It seems that the coronavirus, I think, has brought this issue into slightly sharper focus for people that may in the past have been less interested in election interference or what Russia and China do in terms of disinformation, what their agencies do. But this is happening in the middle of a public health emergency. And in the past, in the public health emergency, governments would rely on national broadcasters and a responsible and accountable press in order to get its message across. But it's much harder to do that when people's attention is diverted away from those traditional means of communication to the social media world that they live in and spend growing amounts of their time in. And certainly in the UK, YouTube is the most watched information channel, including the BBC, for all adults under the age of 35. And I think for all adults in total, it's the third most popular screen time, eyeball time of the day. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, is that these things have kind of monopolies on human attention. And, you know, we like to say that the attention economy is beneath all other economies, because there's nothing that doesn't rely on your attention. You know, newspapers might have thought that they were in the truth business, but truth runs on attention. And if they can't get people's attention, then they're going to do whatever it takes to get people's attention. You know, politicians might think they're in the elections business, but elections depend on getting people's attention. So they're actually competing for your attention. And the problem is, these large technology companies, as you know from, you know, our earlier work, are caught in this race to the bottom of the brainstem to use behavioral design sort of techniques to more and more aggressively capture human attention for lower and lower cost. So if you compare, for example, you know, a newspaper to produce an amount of human attention had to pay these journalists, these editors, that cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to pay these journalists and editors to think about and interview and double fact check what might be true before they publish it, and to think critically about what should we publish and what shouldn't we publish. Is it time to publish this information yet on coronavirus? And we don't know yet, you know, what's really there. Maybe we should wait a little bit. Compared to another more aggressive actor, where Facebook just says, hey, what if I could convince each person to be narcissistically addicted to how much attention they get from other people, and to do all that kind of, you know, creation of attentional objects of their own posts, their own cat videos, their own anecdotes about what their friends said in the hospital on coronavirus, they'll do that work for free. So if you compare these two black boxes, one is the newspapers, the BBC, you know, and all the sort of costs that go into producing that amount of human attention versus this other black box called Facebook, which has essentially, you know, 3 billion narcissistically addicted, you know, social animals doing this labor, this attentional labor for free. That's the cheaper model. And then they have more aggressive ways of getting that attention out there. So they're sort of taking over and replacing our trust-based, slow-moving, information-producing environment with a gossip-based, exponential hearsay-based, anecdote-based information environment. And while there are many goods that can come from that, because you can have people who are spotting things that the media did not see, which has been the case in coronavirus, there are people who tracked this virus earlier than certain governments and certain public media institutions had actually been able to talk about it. We have this problem that the responsibility loop has been taken away, because, you know, a BBC would feel responsible if they say something and then, you know, they're wrong. People will hopefully catch that, and there's a sense of skin in the game. But in the case of each of us, we can share quick anecdotes and claim that 5G and conspiracy theories are, you know, coronavirus conspiracy theories are connected, and we'll bear no cost because it's just part of the noise and the story moves on. So I think that's the real problem, is we've lost the skin in the game in our media ecosystem. So none of us are responsible for the information we share. And that's a real problem we have to fix. I mean, I think we just have to make sure everybody understands, if you don't have a good, authentic basis for what is true in your society, the information going in your society, think of this like maybe you don't know this because in the UK, but the Flint water supply in Michigan for our mines, the lead in the water supply in that whole town there that poisoned the entire town. This is like the Flint water supply for the global information brain, for the way that all of our brains make sense of things, including, governance. And so the basis of our choices is the information environment. If the information environment is polluted, then we have a poorer and poorer basis for making effective choices, and that actually costs lives.
One of the big questions that recurs, I think, is, well, we say to the big tech companies, why don't you do more to tackle this sort of disinformation, these sorts of problems? Why don't you do more to protect people or intervene when people may be engaging with content that will cause them physical harm? Either through a medical conspiracy theory or images or content that will affect their mental health. And then we constantly have this recurring question, why can't they do more? Do we have to legislate to make them do it? Because it seems that they have the power to do it, because this sort of identification of people and what they're interested in and what they're engaging with, they do that already to make money. They do that already to sell ads. So why can't they use that same technology to do good?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we wrote an article for Wired Magazine saying, they have the power to do a lot of good here, and they're not using it. But there's sort of two parts to your question. So let me just keep going with the first part, and then I'll go back to the earlier part. We like to say that so far around coronavirus, the technology companies have been using something like 20th century public service announcement technology, while they actually, on their advertising side, give 21st century micro-targeted, A/B tested, machine learning optimized advertising tools. This is kind of concealing the amount of actual power they have to reach, 3 billion people. And early on in the virus, especially when time really mattered, we argued that the technology companies are the only actor that can reach 3 billion people before the virus can. I mean, think about WhatsApp, and places that are more remote in Brazil. And if you have, in that case, a Brazilian government who's claiming that, I think Bolsonaro was claiming that there is basically no risk, and it's not even worse than a cough or a slightly bad flu, the technology companies can actually help enhance social norms. So, for example, helping you in WhatsApp, giving you a one-click prompt that says, "Do you want to add a mask to your face image?" Because it's really important that we all wear masks right now, and this is what this is how many lives you can save by doing it, based on estimations of how much this has affected other countries. They could do that public service announcement in a way that's very personal, and letting you change your profile photo, and then letting you broadcast that to everyone else in WhatsApp, so that when you're scrolling through your feed, it starts to highlight, the ones with the mask on and like maybe a red circle around your profile photo. So it starts to look like it's becoming a social norm. Now everyone's doing it and I'm not. And so therefore I should do it more. That's a persuasive design technique that they have the capacity to do. And in fact, it's actually through lobbying of I was helping with this. There was a group called Quarantine, which actually got Facebook to do these one-click profile photos that say, stay home to save lives, and then put a mask on and put a little red circle around your profile photo. And then later this became Sheryl Sandberg actually doing this for her own photo, and then they built it right into the product. So that's the kind of thing where, you know, that's baby steps in the right direction. I think this is forcing them though to, you know, really ask themselves, how do we really take responsibility for this when we see a diversity of government approaches? And then again, you ended up this question of, should they play God when they, you know, are going against the local concerns of local governments? And which do you trust more? Do you trust Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, or do you trust, you know, Bolsonaro in Brazil? Who's the right person to make this choice? And it's uncomfortable because we wouldn't want them to have this much power in the first place, but we're in this uncomfortable position where they do have this power, and they can't pretend that they're not putting their hand on the steering wheel. Because, you know, I think part of what's also been happening here is they have been hiding under the fiction of neutrality for the last 10 years. They've been saying, we're just a neutral platform. You choose your friends, you choose the articles you like, you choose what you share. You know, we're just neutral. It's the ultimate democracy. Whatever people like the most, click the most, share the most, you know, rises to the top. But that looks like neutrality from the outside, but it's like a magician who's saying, look, did you pick the card, you know, that I you know, handed you? Did I influence your choice in any way? No, it looks like it's neutral. But in fact, the deck has been stacked in a certain way. And in this case, the deck is stacked towards the human amygdala, meaning that the human amygdala, the fear part of the brain, is on the scale. That's the finger that's on the scale in the case of what our information environment looks like when you run it off of clicks, likes, and shares. And that fiction of neutrality is turning out to be a fiction. And now there's this uncomfortable position where technology platforms have to say, okay, I was putting my finger on the scale. So how do I consciously shift the position of that finger and have that position of a finger not be governed by whatever is in the best interests of advertisers or what makes the most money, but especially in a time of a crisis and a chronic ongoing crisis like a pandemic, how do we, you know, be pushing our, you know, moving our finger on the scale in the direction of the public interest?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think we can see I can see a problem coming in the near future, which is that if we get to a point where we've got a tested vaccine for COVID-19 that we know works, and we want to roll it out around the world, we are going to run into, I'm sure, the problem of the anti-vaccine movement, you know, trying to undermine confidence. There's already evidence that's going on.
I wouldn't say this is happening in the future. I would say this is actually talking to people at the platforms. We know that they're actually doing that right now. There's huge amounts of activity to debase future trust in any vaccine. And so this is why the war happens often preemptively months and months ahead of when the actual decision will be made.
Yeah, but I suppose it's only in the future in the sense that we don't have the vaccine, but the anti-vaccine, the anti-vac campaigners are already, as you say, already up and running. But this is, in some ways, this is a really clear example where that we've got a public health crisis, which has cost hundreds of thousands of lives. It's going to cause the biggest economic shutdown that could affect people's welfare and jobs for generations to come. The vaccine will be one of the most important ways out of this crisis. And surely, if there was ever a time where we needed the tech companies to step up to the plate, this will be it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why we're saying this is also, I think, the first of a long-term shift in orientation that they have to actually operate in the public interest. I mean, we've often recently talked about their impact on climate change. If look at this, I mean, in the case of this, right, we have a need to flatten the curve based on a science-based view of a threat that has an exponential growth. So the case of the virus grows exponentially. Human minds are really bad at perceiving exponential curves. Governments move kind of slow. And we have science evidence that says this is how fast it's going to grow. We need people to take this action ahead of time. The companies are kind of like this lighthouse where they can, you know, hold their hand over their head and their eyes and look out ahead of the head and say, this is the thing that's coming. In fact, they can do better predictive epidemiology than probably the WHO and the CDC, meaning that based on what people are saying in their news feeds and what kind of symptoms people are reporting and patterns of friendships and relationships and location, et cetera, they actually probably have more information about how to predict hotspots than any global public health institution that exists right now. You can think of it as, you know, if they were truly operating in the public interest, then when Trump was doing his press briefings and saying, well, here's what we're seeing with the virus, instead of calling up the guy from the CDC to do a report on it, you could imagine him calling up Zuckerberg, and Zuckerberg could give a far more detailed analysis of what's happening in each state, you know, in each country, based on the kinds of patterns that they see as a company. Now, should they be in that position, again, is another question, but that's the position that they are in. But I wanted to make the point that, you know, if they're doing this for a science-based threat around an exponential curve that's going to eclipse our systems, the capacities of our systems, they could do the same thing for climate change, right? What I mean is, climate change is another exponential threat, something that grows ahead of, you know, in a way that our brains can't tend to process very well. There's a lot of misinformation and denial about it, but we know it to be true. And instead of providing us with endless climate fear articles and clickbait, you can imagine the entire tech industry taking a public orientation stance towards helping us act ahead of the crisis, taking all the steps that we need in a public health-oriented way, a public resilience-oriented way, that could look like, you know, enabling us to take the kinds of collective actions that would actually help get ahead of the crisis. So join your local Extinction Rebellion group, divest money from fossil fuels, start community gardens in your spaces. Here's how to do solar panels, letting us see how our actions could add up to bigger changes. It's kind of like if you remember the Wikipedia donations, where when Wikipedia asks you to donate every year, they say, if everybody who saw this just donated, you know, £5 right now, we would actually fundraise for all of Wikipedia overnight. Well, Facebook could do that for climate change and say, if everybody who saw this did exactly this set of things, we would knock out, you know, 2% from our emissions right now, and then give us the kinds of choices that can act in that way. There's a very big, you know, shift in the way that they could be presenting choices, because, you know, in human beings, we're only as good as the menus being offered to us. And right now, technology companies have created the daily menus of sense making and choice making that our minds are constrained by. And so how can they put new choices on life's menu that are actually in our global public long-term interest, that especially help us escape the short-term traps of our limited Paleolithic brains?
And the final question for me, there's a lot of talk about whether the AI will play an increased role in helping to, you know, perfect the way the systems work. Obviously, there's a huge amount of AI built into them already. Is it about sort of developing new technologies, or is it simply just about the people at the top of these companies making different choices in the way they want these companies to work?
Yeah, unfortunately, AI, this is a really important point. AI cannot know truth. It cannot know what is a conspiracy theory and what is real. It cannot know these things. Machines cannot know these things. And so what that means is, you know, if you create a problem of such vast scale and harm, I mean, essentially, you know, they've granted the power of gods to individuals. You know, now each of us can reach a BBC-sized audience. I mean, imagine we just play this game out, you know, a few more years, and now instead of having, you know, 30,000 followers on Twitter, you know, everyone has, let's say, 1 million followers plus on Twitter, or on Facebook, or on Instagram, or whatever. You know, that's a lot of psychological influence. You know, you and I are each holding the kind of attentional, what's the phrase I'm thinking? I'm thinking of Zeus, you know, and the sort of shaft that he holds in his hand. You know, we have the attentional powers of a god, but we don't have the wisdom, prudence, or, you know, positive interest of a god, right? We're just spouting off the random thing we heard from our friends. And that's really dangerous. And if you think about how much power should each of us have to reach other people, you know, how much wiser am I than any other person? I mean, so if you think, you know, when one person, when Alex Jones, who's the conspiracy theorist in the United States, he was able to be recommended by YouTube 15 billion times. Is Alex Jones 15 billion times wiser than every other person? You know, I think the scale of our speech should be governed by the scale of our wisdom. And how much more wise is one person versus another that we would say, you know, attention should really be going to this person out of the exclusion of the other. I mean, imagine being like a small group setting. And when someone who really just likes to talk but has no wisdom, you know, shares and shares and shares and shares, our attention is not being constrained by or coupled with what the wisdom of the speech is. And I think we have to look at the ratios of how much wiser is one voice over another. And we've given people the kind of amplification of gods, or, you know, Hitler-sized stadiums, or Alex Jones-sized, you know, traffic, you know, that's bigger than the BBC, Guardian, Washington Post combined, with 15 billion recommendations, without having the kind of responsibility. And this is where that phrase, freedom of speech is not the same thing as freedom to reach. meaning everyone has the right to speak, but we don't each have some God-given right to reach millions and millions of people. I think the unfortunate reality we have to face as a public is that each of us are addicted to having that much influence power. And once we have it, we really don't want to give it away. You know, I know having 70,000 followers or whatever on Twitter, I'm not keen, given that we're trying to change the system, to give up that power, obviously, because we want to make the system better. But this is the problem that we really face, is we've granted these kinds of broadcasting powers without the responsibility of broadcasters.
Absolutely. And would you think over the, you know, broadcasting as a public concept is nearly 100 years old. And over that time, we've built various checks and balances around the people that hold that power, be it through broadcasting licenses or publisher responsibility and other things as well. And the sorts of responsibilities and liabilities just don't exist in most of the social media world.
That's exactly right. And that's you know, going back to the very first point on the podcast, is that whatever responsibilities that a publisher has in the physical age or the broadcast age, when you move them digitally online and they're just an individual, they just lose all those responsibilities. Take a simple example of children's television. We used to regulate in the United States what you can and can't say on Saturday morning cartoons and what can be in an advertisement. As far as I remember, you couldn't even put a URL, meaning the HTTP, www, in an advertisement for children. And that was regulated. And then as soon as you take YouTube for kids, or YouTube taking over children's TV Saturday morning, you lose those protections. Now it's actually the opposite. It's just URL, 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 just pushing you to the next video, next thing. It's the exact opposite of the protections that we've had. And so in general, what we need to do is go on this kind of mass excavation, recovery mission for all of these protections that we, for good reasons and principles, had created for our previous information and, you know, attention environment, and kind of start figuring out how do we apply them. So how do we have skin in the game responsibility, so people are responsible for the things that they say, and there's visibility if they're wrong. And that will create the kind of natural feedback loops of wanting to say and share less if we're not actually experts. I mean, I am not a microbiologist, so I have no interest in telling other people what is or isn't true about the virus. Why would I do that? I don't know. And you can imagine a new kind of media environment that actually has that incentive, where people are only sharing because they'll actually lose kind of reputational points in the system, or access in the system, if the things that they're saying turn out to not be true. And so we need a system that you know, preemptively disincentivizes people to share when they actually don't know. And I think that would be a much healthier system, because each of us could focus much more on our learning and only, you know, have a higher quality information environment.
Absolutely right. Thank you. We're joined on the podcast, as always, by Dr. Charles Creel and by John Quinlan. And Charles, you keep a beady eye on the things people get wrong on social media. What's caught your attention in the last couple of days?
Thanks, Damien. Well, I've been paying a lot of attention to social media and straightforward media as well. On an earlier podcast, we looked at the problem of comparing one country's COVID figures with another. And there are several websites like Covidly and others where you can go and see the figures for each country. And although the public often uses these figures to gauge how bad things might be in their own country, it's challenging to derive too much meaning from them. Each country is on its own trajectory, with virus arriving at different times. Each country has its own flavor of measurement, and testing is inconsistent in much of the world. But if we localize this, just focusing on one country, I found myself wondering if we could establish just how many people have died in the UK, just the UK, from COVID. And fortunately, Robert Cuff, the BBC's head of statistics, has written a great online piece on counting COVID in the UK. And his findings point out what a massive piece of misinformation is wrapped around this issue. Now, according to Cuff, the best way to measure deaths from COVID is by looking at the number of deaths over and above the usual that we would have at this time of year. And this is something The Economist recently wrote an article about as well. His findings are really shocking. By his new configuration, Cuff estimates that more than 50,000 people have died in the UK from coronavirus. Meanwhile, the official figure is, as of today, 33,000 something. Why the discrepancy? The government relies on the Department of health and social care's count of deaths of people who test positive for coronavirus. And since only a tiny fraction of people in Britain have actually had the test, a huge number of COVID-19 deaths are missed completely. Now, this not only misses people who've died without a test, but it also misses people who've died in the community who've also not had a test. On top of that, the different nations of the UK are arriving at their figures differently. So, for example, England excludes deaths from outside of hospital, but Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland don't. So why do we use the 33,000 figure at all if it's not accurate? Well, one reason might be that scientists want to monitor epidemic growth patterns with precision, but for a holistic understanding of the scale of the crisis, 33,000 deaths gives completely the wrong picture. So the conclusion is that the number of people who've died because of COVID-19 is nearly twice as high as the figure we hear announced every day at government press conferences. We're usually hearing bad information. Now, on the other side of the Atlantic, the Trump administration is engaged in an active work of disinformation around the same issue. Trump's top medical expert on the coronavirus task force, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who everyone knows by now, has said that coronavirus deaths are being undercounted for the same reason we've just outlined about the UK figure. But despite this, The Sun is reporting that Trump is pressuring the Center for Disease Control to change its death toll methodology and produce a lower figure. Dr. Deborah Birx, she's the coordinator of Trump's coronavirus task force, has lobbied for two categories of deaths to be excluded. That's people who likely had COVID but didn't test, and people who definitely had the virus but died from something else. Bob Anderson, the mortality statistics chief at the CDC, has faith in his method despite this, and he says doctors are already specifically asked whether the coronavirus caused the death, and he agrees with Fauci, the U.S. is undercounting deaths. So it's an election cycle. It's silly season in America, but this is not so silly. We may see death figures actually go down when in fact they're going up.
I think that's absolutely right, Charles. It's a really serious issue, and I'm sure when all this is done and dusted, there'll be probably a number of inquiries looking into the way in which these figures were recorded. But John, perhaps I could bring you in as well at this point. What's been happening at Invitation? What's caught your eye on the fact-checking sites in the last few days?
Yes, Damien. So I think we're still seeing a bit of a hangover, actually, on the plandemic video that was going around last week, and we're still getting people asking us if it's true or not, or any of the claims in it true. And obviously, you know, nearly all of them have been completely disproved, and there's been quite a lot which have just been used out of context. But I just wanted to talk just sort of a minute or two on why we think we're still getting stuff about that video and why it's done so well, because most of the stuff that we get is usually, a WhatsApp picture or someone just making an image on Facebook that's been shared, and it's just so different from anything we've seen before in that respect. You know, this is a 25-minute long, quite slick production. I mean, it wouldn't look out of place on Netflix, for example, and I think that's why it's sort of caught people's eye. And you know, in an era and an age where social media is creating stars, and Charles mentioned Dr. Fauci just there, you know, one of the key things in this video is almost like a sort of personal attack on him. And, you know, that's something that has certainly caught people's imagination. The star, if I can use the word, or one of the stars of the video, Judy Mikovits, has actually gained over 130,000 Twitter followers for herself in less than a month from this. So it's very interesting how it's evolved, and it's something that we may see more of in the future. I don't know, but it was certainly something that's different from our point of view.
And absolutely, and I mean, Tristan, going back to what we were talking about a few moments ago, the danger is greater when the sophistication of disinformation reaches new heights as well. And this film is a good example of that. But you add to that the growing danger of deep fake films, where probably it'll be even harder to not just spot a film that has been filmed with real people, but telling a false story, but scenarios that are totally fabricated using deep fake technology to create something that no one ever said or never really happened.
Yeah, well, I like to think of these issues now. You know, it's interesting what the gift of coronavirus has been, that many more people are aware of epidemiology. So the notion of, you know, R0 or R naught, you know, for a given virus, how many people does it infect? And then the notion of wearing masks and the notion of washing your hands. You can think of the same metaphors for information. Here's this mimetic virus of plandemic, right? Now, the problem with disinformation is it all plays on partial truths. So there's a partial truth. So there's probably a set of partial truths. I actually haven't seen the whole video. I'm honestly exhausted by the fact that there's just hundreds and hundreds of these examples. And it's like I Love Lucy and the Chocolate Factory, where you just, you know, the chocolates are going by way, way faster than the tech companies can possibly pick up and stop, you know, the sort of whack-a-mole, infinite whack-a-mole game. But I think, though, the interesting thing is to think about our information environment in terms of information hygiene. You know, what is the equivalent of the R naught for plandemic? Well, just look at the name, plandemic. Plandemic makes it sound, it fits into that little bias, that conspiracy part of your brain, which is there for everyone. Everyone's just wondering, you know, is this a plan? Is this, everyone's got that thought in the back of their mind. And this is a video that even if you don't even watch it, just, you know, seeing the title, it confirms that kind of conspiracy theory part of your brain. So it has a kind of mimetic load, right? It has a capacity to sort of entice the mind. And that means that it infects a lot of other people. A lot of people want to share it, and it's high production value. That increases the kind of viral sharing, you know, rate, they are not of the video. And it has certain, you know, compelling, historically presented things. But then it infects people. And for each person it infects, you know, we're not really washing our hands before we get it, right? Our immune systems are also down. I mean, what's the equivalent of our thinking immune system is down? Well, we're guided by fear. We're guided by uncertainty. That's like, you know, being, you know, getting exposed to the coronavirus when you don't actually have a strong immune system because you haven't had vitamin D or sunlight or been outside. So when we think about this as an information epidemiology problem, you can kind of start asking yourself, well, what's the equivalent of, you know, putting a mask on or washing your hands? It would be, you know, I'm going to put a mask on, which means I'm not going to just let all this stuff into my brain just because it's being shared by everyone. I'm going to start washing my hands, meaning I'm not just going to share things virally or, you know, without friction. I'm going to actually put some friction into the system. You can think of it as also, you know, we talk about with viruses, viral shedding, that viruses shed shed these viruses everywhere we go, where the more we walk around with this mimetic virus of, say, plandemic, we're shedding biases for other people to be more and more confused because we're causing more and more people to be infected with a confusing bias to look for confirming evidence in the wrong direction. And then if you think about the analogy of zinc lozenges and you know, vitamin C, what's the equivalent of taking information or truth-seeking vitamin C and zinc lozenges? Meaning, how do we enhance our critical thinking so that we're just not even really enticed by these things in the first place? So I think there's some really interesting metaphors because people have now seen and thought about viruses as a spreadable thing, and they can now see the problems in our information environment as kind of spreadable mimetic viruses that we have to be better at controlling and protecting.
And what's your, I mean, perhaps a final question for the podcast. How would you design the delivery mechanism for a vaccine against a mimetic virus?
Well, I think the first thing is we have to be careful about, you know, not wanting to say we're in this good pristine state and now we just need to change what the technology companies are doing. I think we need almost like a truth and reconciliation level moment where we have a truth and reconciliation, you know, campaign commission that says, this is this false hypnotic spell that literally 3 billion people have been hypnotized by this kind of breakdown of truth into 3 billion Truman shows, 3 billion individually programmed personalized channels that we're all living in. And we've all been hypnotized by this false information environment, which has distorted each of the biases that each of our brains are running. We have to be able to, you know, climb up to a higher metacognitive perch to see and look down on the kind of pig's pen of the kind of messy, you know, information disorder that has befallen our society. If we can't acknowledge that that's actually where we've started, where we're now starting from, then solutions are not going to be sufficient because we actually haven't fully acknowledged what has happened to our society, that we've all been kind of confused by this information disorder as caused by this mass personalization, micro-targeting, amplification process of social media. So that's, I think, the first step is that's the first step of the vaccine. That's like, you know, vaccines, you know, action, you know, first action is that it does that. The second action is that I think having a whole new different set of social sharing norms. You know, why would you share anything if you don't have expertise or knowledge behind it? You know, also, what kind of amplification do we want? Do we want a world where everyone gets to be their own BBC-sized publisher and reach millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people? You know, are we each hundreds of thousands of times more wise than the person who's listening to us so that there's a relevant ratio there? No. So how do we design information environments that kind of mimic, I think, of biomimicry like in nature? You know, how do we mimic the kind of social sharing processes that happen that we were evolved for? And I think, you know, just being more thoughtful about how our own minds work. I think most people, we don't self-reflect and really understand that we have cognitive biases, that if, you know, the more people who we trust share something, the more we'll share something. We don't really see these heuristics that we're using. And I think if we don't understand the limits of our own brains, then they will simply run us, which is true for, you know, everything else in our lives. When we don't understand that there's like a anxiety running underneath the hood before we grab the M&Ms, then we're going to keep grabbing the M&Ms. And if we can actually see the anxiety that preceded that, that gives us more choice. You know, awareness brings the opportunity for choice. So I think overall, this is kind of a moment of self-reflection as a species where we can see that technology has mass hypnotized our lower level, you know, vulnerabilities in our brains. And we need to be able to see and spot that and name that before we can get agency over it. So I think that's, I don't know, hopefully the first step of a kind of a information vaccine. I would love to talk to you more about it later.
Absolutely. We could spend hours talking about it. But it was interesting you used the term truth and reconciliation, which obviously was the process adopted by Nelson Mandela in post-apartheid South Africa. It does bring the question is whether it takes a major crisis or the resolution of a major crisis to make people confront these issues in that way. And maybe The coronavirus will provide that sort of that crisis that'll make us really look at the way people receive information and the facts they're given to help them process it.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm hoping for. I think this is the mother of all demos, to use a Silicon Valley term. this is the mother of all demonstrations of the problems that social media has placed on society in its intrinsic design and structure. Again, not because I think people who run technology companies are categorically evil, although there are a couple examples. I think this is just a demonstration of how, you know, unfortunate and bad design that was based on a business model of harvesting people's attention that led to all of these bad dynamics of amplification, micro-targeting, you know, persuasion, et cetera. And that we're now seeing that for the first time. We're seeing the cost of that in terms of life and death, framed in you know, body bags. And I think just like, you know, what happened with tobacco, where we framed the cost in terms of the number of body bags that we now saw that had been the cost of this kind of mass influence campaign and mass addiction. I think here we're kind of seeing the same thing. And I hope it does lead to a real moment of saying this is the moment to move to a public interest technology infrastructure that is humane and puts society's interests first and not advertisers.
So who's in the categorically evil box?
maybe I shouldn't be so bold to say, but I do think that there's if your heroes are Emperor Augustus and Roman emperors who wanted world domination, then you may not have society's best interests at heart if you're running one of the largest companies in history.
Yeah, that's a good place in which to draw things together.
I'm only following in your footsteps as a politician, so we'll
it'd be great to have. Maybe we could ask him on the show and put those questions.
Yes,
to him.
That, yeah, I think you should if you can get.
It's not been very easy. He's a difficult man to track down, as we know.
I know. So, I think we've been playing that game for a couple of years now, you and I, Damien.
Tristan, thanks so much for joining us all the way from California and being on the podcast. It's been great to talk to you again.
Likewise, thank you so much.
And Charles, John, thanks so much for being with us again. And we'll look forward to joining you again on the next podcast. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. It's great to be here.
Cheers. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Tristan Harris, Charles Creel, and John Quinlan. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagent and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website,
infotagen.com or using hashtag isolate the lies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you until next time.